And all of you have a story to say this morning, a story to tell. And a part of that story always has something to do with our Father as we reflect our story. So my question to you, the first question I have for you this morning is, are you a good male? Are you living out what God has stamped on the DNA of your soul? That you are a male, that you are designed to remember, that you are Zakar. And that as you remember, you share stories, and especially to your children, about where you come from. And not everything about where you come from is good. There's a lot of good stuff if you're raised in a Christian home. A lot of good memories, and we're supposed to talk about those. But we're also supposed to remember those things that have given us some grief and given us some pain. Because it's in remembering that we learn. It's in remembering that we can change. It's in remembering that we can help our children and tell stories that will change the next generation. If we choose not to remember, if we choose not to be fully male, if we choose to push those things aside and saying, I'm not going to remember that because it's too painful, it left an indelible mark in my heart, a vacuum in my soul, I ain't gone there. There's something about that peace that we're going to lose in our connection, relationships with men around us, with our spouse. Several stories. There's a basketball player way back, well, I think he retired maybe in the early 2000s, 2003, 4, 5, I don't know. Dennis Rodman. How many of you have heard of Dennis Rodman? He was called the bad boy in basketball. And I remember in the 90s when the guy was quite a rebounder. He could rebound probably better than anybody else in the NBA. So he was a good athlete. He could flat out just go up and get the ball. But off the court, the guy was a mess. Actually, he brought a lot of that mess onto the court. The guy would come with all color hair, tattoos. The guy would decorate himself in all sorts of ways. He made the Sports Illustrated cover different times with outlandish, outrageous costumes. And I never knew who he was. And when I would see him, there was always this, ugh. Like. And then one day I heard his story, or a bit of where he came out of. He never knew his dad. His dad left before he was born, I think, or when he was just a little tight. Never knew his dad. Sports Illustrated chased down his father. They found him in the Philippines living with another woman. He had fathered 29 children. They said, what is your goal for life? And he said, my goal is to father 30 children. Fathering for 30 children and having never poured any of his heart or things that really matter into the life of his children. So that's radical, graphic on that side. Another one has results that would be worse yet is in the 1980s, there's this guy. How many of you ever heard of Jeffrey Dahmer? He was a psycho. He killed 17 people. He lived in Milwaukee. I remember I might have been early 20s when all this story was unfolding where they finally caught up with this Jeffrey Dahmer. And not only would he kill his victims, he would dismember them. And he actually did some cannibalism. He ended up in prison, got 975 years. 2 years in his prison term, he was murdered in prison. When he was murdered, scientists and biologists, they wanted his brain. They said, we want to see if there's some kind of genetic makeup to determine what caused this man to be the way he is. His mom right away said, yeah, we'd like to know, you know. But his dad said, no, I can't handle that. And his dad didn't allow them to do whatever research they wanted to do. But it kept haunting his father, who was a professor at a university, over the next couple years. And he began to really do a heart search of why his son turned out the way he did. He was raised in a what you would call upper middle class, most certainly middle class home. But what was missing? Why did his son turn out the way he did? And he wrote a book called The Father's Story, A Father's Story. And in that story, Lionel Dahmer, he made this comment about his son. And so I was there. I wasn't there to see him as he began to sink into himself. I wasn't there to sense that he might be drifting toward that unimaginable realm of fantasy and isolation that it would take nearly 30 years to recognize. He began to see that there are some huge deficits. He went on to say in that book that there was a lot of domestic stuff between him and his wife. And he was doing his graduate work, he's doing his PhD work when Jeffrey was just a little boy. He was completely consumed in his own life, and he had nothing to offer his son. Well, there's a lot of fathers that don't have a lot to offer their son, even though they're at home. Some of you will have stories about having very, very busy fathers. It feels like it's a radical, incredible, a step from a very busy father wrapped up in his own world, having a son that moved way out. And so there's still a lot of pieces that are really hard to fathom. But there's a few things in this statement that I want to point out to you. Twice here he says, I wasn't there. I wasn't there. Let me go back to that. I thought I had some. He says, I wasn't there, and I wasn't there. The reality for him was that he really wasn't there for his son. The second thing is that he said, he began to sink into himself. As he reflected on his son, he realized that his son wasn't present. There's things going on. And then he said that he might have been drifting away or drifting toward that unimaginable realm. But the one word that stands out to me is the word sense. I wasn't there to sense, to feel. I wasn't there to pick up what was going on. And when I reflect back on my childhood, and primarily, how many of you still have your father that lives this morning? So most of you do. Some of you have. My dad passed away in 99. So I have memories. I don't have my father here with me anymore. How many of you have sons this morning? Wow. So a lot of you will be doing kind of a double. You know, you'll be reflecting on your father and you'll be reflecting on your fatherhood. And that's okay this morning. But primarily, I'd like for you to stay with being a son. But in this picture here, when he talks about, I wasn't there to sense, what I hear him saying is, I didn't have a clue what was going on. I didn't see. I didn't pick up. I didn't have this awareness. And I want to suggest to you this morning, men, that each one of us has the innate gift from God to be able to pick up when our sons are drifting. Oh, there's many times when I'm so grateful when Kathy says, Sam, can we talk? Have you noticed? I've just been aware of. And I begin to see that too, more clearly. And so I've been very grateful for a wife that has been able to sense things when I haven't. But there is no way this morning that any of us here are going to do well as a father if we're not there to sense. And you're not going to be there to sense if you're not there, or if your heart's not there. In the limited amount of time we have, being gone all day and coming home evenings and weekends basically is what we have with our sons and daughters. If we're not there to sense, if we're not there to feel, one of the things that I've had to make a very cognitive decision, I have a 10-minute drive home from Life Ministries, and there's many times when I leave Life Ministries, there's a place in that 10-minute drive, 8-minute drive home that I cross the Conestoga River. At that point, I choose mentally. I say, if I'm still thinking about Life Ministries, I leave my stuff on that bridge. And I say, God, tomorrow morning when I come back through, the bucket that I have, I'll scoop it up again. I'll pick it up. But at that point, I try to leave my stuff, whatever it is. And I begin to think the last 2 minutes on my way home, 2-3 minutes. What could my family have dealt with today that I know about? When I walk into that door, I'm going to enter into, again, a realm that for 8-10 hours, life was spilling out all over the floor. Yeah, we talk occasionally on the phone. But for the most part, I don't know what's going on. I haven't sensed. And unless I come into this home prepared in my heart, looking, I'm not going to sense what's going on. And That's one of the reasons that I burned out back in the early years when I was counseling, is because I took whatever I had. I kept taking it with me wherever I went, and I never was able to remove myself and step back. And not only did I burn out, my wife crashed, and that's another story. So this is what I see. Now, just to look at percentages of fathers being in the homes, growing up with their children, this is what they had from 1960 to 1990, and then I have some current statistics. But in 1960, I was born in 1961, 82.5% of fathers were at home with their children. Only 17.5% were not. In 1970, it dropped 5%, 10 years later. And this was now post, 1960 was post-World War II. A lot more people were out working. By 1970, more women were out working. And it was now, the hippie movement was going on. Modernism. We're just beginning to enter into the postmodernist world here. In 1980, 67%, it dropped 10% in that decade. So now 32% of children are alone at home without their fathers, biological fathers. In 1990, it was 61%. Today, it's less than 50%. Over 40% of children today are living apart from their biological fathers. The best statistic that I saw is that 48% of all children, by the time they're 18, will either live with a stepfather or a single family situation. 48% of our children. Unbelievable statistics. When I think about when I was born in 1960 and in that decade, that most children in, had their dads around them. Just a quick breakdown here on white children living without their fathers, only 28%, and black children all the way up. The difference there between white and black, 69% of white black males are not living with their sons. Unbelievable. Almost 70%, 7 out of 10, they don't have their sons with them. Way back in 1600s, 90% of American youngsters turned 18 with two living parents. I'm sorry, 31%, today it's 90% living. But at 31%, they still were just as well off. They still had just as many parents in the home as they do in America today. If you take 90% and break that down to the percentage of fathers that are in the home, where 31 of them had both parents alive, and yet most of the parents were there. Scripture says that the glory of sons is their fathers. That we, when as little boys grow up, we want to be around our dads. And there's nothing that is more invigorating for fathers to pour their hearts into their sons and for sons to experience that from their fathers. You know, some of the things that I miss today with my dad is sometimes I'm around a man, or I have this smell, this masculine smell, this, and it's a bit of a body odor, it's a bit of a sweaty smell. It's not a stench, it's not a clean smell either. But whenever I smell that smell, it takes me back to my father. Many, many times when I was a boy growing up, my dad was a builder, and we would, when I was a lad, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, all those years, I would go with my dad to work on a hot summer day, driving home in the truck. It was a bad smell then. Going home in the pickup truck, my older brother was driving, my next brother was beside me, and my dad was on the far side, and I was tucked in between there. And I still remember that smell, that aroma from my dad. And when I smell it today, it just takes me back. It's a good memory. A good memory of a hard-working father who provided and gave and gave. A couple years before my father died, he began to have mini strokes, and he was in the hospital. And one day I was sitting there with my father in the hospital, and he was comatose. He had had a mini stroke, and he was laying there at the hospital bed, and I was just looking at my father and watching my dad, and I was thinking back. And after a while, I turned and I looked out the window, and here was a landscape of Columbus. And my mind, the reality was that for 40 years, every day, most every day, never Sundays, but most every day, and oftentimes on holidays, my father would be out there somewhere across that landscape in Columbus, building homes. But time had now changed, and he was now on the hospital bed. And as I sat there and watched my dad breathing, trying to breathe, fighting to breathe, and recognizing how my dad, over all this time, had poured his life into just hands working hard, building. And now, dramatically, it changed. It never went back to where my father could work again. And I was proud of my dad, laying there, that he had given for 40 years. The glory of sons is their father. Tim, would you play that clip? Street. I don't know what that evokes inside of you when you see fathers and sons connecting like that. I get warm feelings, fuzzy feelings on one hand because I love to do that with my sons. I also get a bit of a lonely feeling because I didn't do much of that with my dad. I don't remember putting my arms around him like that and looking him in the eyes and smiling and connecting at that level. My oldest son was 6 when he died. My next son was 3. And I know he loved his grandsons. My last recording of my father that I have, or the last thing I have of my dad, was a telephone conversation that he had with my son's other grandparents. He had left a message on their answering machine, and it was about my son Matthew, and he had been at Dad's place. And so my father called the other grandparent, and you can feel the pride in my father. Well, let's talk about the absent father wound. An absent father wound is an ongoing emotional, social, or spiritual deficit ordinarily met in a healthy relationship with Dad that must now be overcome by other means. When there is an absent father wound, either physically absent or spiritually absent, emotionally absent, some kind of relational absence, it's going to have to be met some other way. There's going to be some method of interaction or some method of relieving that pain that it develops from the deficit of not having a father speak into a son's life. When I was 16, 17, I began to find other means. And when I look back today, I realize that my father was an incredibly hard worker, and he provided well in so many ways. But emotionally and relationally, there was a huge deficit. And when my father wanted to enter into my life at 17 and 18, when I began to act out, and I come home late, and I meet my father would be sitting at the table with a lantern burning, and the lantern had gone dim, because I knew he had been up for a while. When you light a lantern and you pump it, you know, it's bright, and after a while the pressure comes out of it. And I come into the house late in the evening, and the lamp had gone dim. And my father wanted to connect with me, and he'd say, "Samuel, who washed you? Where were you?" At that point, I didn't want to talk to my dad. And it was too late. Or for a season, it was too late. And I look back, and I regret those times. But I can only say to you, the reason that I give is because there was an emotional deficit that my father was unable to pour into his son at those early years in my life. I want you just for a minute. Somehow we got the wrong video up here. That's okay. We'll work through this. But I had my own video and I put it on my desktop, and somehow this other one came up. They're on the bottom of your page. I just want you to take a minute, and I want you to think of three words that come to your mind. Whenever I sit with men, or anybody, but when I sit with men, we do what we call a genogram. And a genogram is a family history system. And at some point in this genogram, we always put a picture up of Dad and Mom, the siblings. We talk about the family system. But at some point, I say, give me three words that come out that would help me to understand who your father is. And it's interesting, usually a woman or a wife, when she's sitting there, when she talks about her father, she'll get three words in a hurry. But for a man, he'll kind of sit there. You have to think, yeah. So I was thinking I can give you about 10, 15 seconds to come up, but maybe I need to give you about 2-3 minutes to come up with. But just write down three quick words as you reflect on your father. In your group this morning, I hope that you'll be able to spend some time processing that question. Let me tell you real quick the three words that jumped for me. The first word for me was busy. My dad was a busy man. He was different than most men are today, and the way I think it should have been. He had 2 or 3 crews that he was running the whole time, but he was always on the job site. He was working right with them, and he was always a part of whatever was happening. And so, and he did all his prints. He drew up. He was an architect, so he did that all early in the morning. And then in the evening, he'd meet with prospective house owners, whoever we were building for. Or he'd be out in the shop getting things ready. So he'd burn the candle on either end, so He could leave at 6:30 and come home about 6 in the evening, where he would be on the job site. So my dad was very, very busy. The second word that came to mind was my dad was very steady. I never heard my dad raise his voice. I never heard him say anything in anger with a raised voice. My dad was firm. When my dad would say, "Samuel," I knew he was serious. Yeah. He always called me Samuel. But he never raised his voice. He was just very steady. And my dad loved the Lord. My dad was a committed believer. There's many times that I would hear my dad talk on the phone. He would call these professors at Rosedale. I was just talking to Walter Beachy recently. He'd say, "Yeah, I still remember your father." He would call me. And he'd say, "Walter, what do you make out of this passage?" And he would call Elmer Jancy and Willard Mayer and David. From time to time, I'd hear him on the phone, pondering scripture, processing. My dad was a very godly man, a very busy man. But somehow, in his journey as a boy growing up, he was the oldest in his family. And I've done some research, and I've thought and pondered, and I've realized that my father came in adulthood and into fathering himself with his own father wound, the absent father wound. When there's absent father wound, there's anger and pain often that comes out of that. And anger and pain can be expressed in different ways. The thing that's important to you men this morning is that you recognize if there's anger and pain. And so often what happens then for fathers, if they're holding anger from the past, is that it comes out in different ways today. It surfaces in ways that you say, "That's really not what I'm angry about." The second category is Scripture. Ephesians 6:4, that fathers do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. The second category is extreme behavior and addictions or obsessions. If I would say number one is an external expression, I would say number two is also external, but it's flowing out of more, it's more an internal expression. The extreme behavior and addictions or obsessions that one has. Sat with a fellow one time who had been raised in a home where they farmed together, and his father was very abusive, and his father would take it out on him on the farm. And he came to see me one day, and as he came to my office, I could see his eyes were bloodshot, and I knew that he probably had just gotten high on his way over to see me. And so I just mentioned to him, I said, "You look like you have a buzz today." I know how a man looked. He said, "Yeah, I just got done smoking a joint down in the parking lot." Oh, okay. And so we were talking about that, and he realized it's the way he medicates. And then he said, "I'm thankful that I found weed. I'm thankful that I found something to medicate my pain," is what he was saying to me. The third category is an inner sense of incompleteness or lostness. That's where Dennis Rodman comes in. It doesn't have a clue with who he is. This masculine identity crisis. Do you know who you are today as a man? Oftentimes when men don't know who they are, there's this, there's nothing definitive about them. It's just, yeah, they do this crazy erratic stuff, ways to medicate, but you don't see this definitive movement in their masculinity, in their maleness, to move and to enter into relationships that matter, because they don't know that they have what it takes on the inside to do that, to be that way, because it's never been poured into them. We'll talk more about that next week. And the fourth category, and this is pretty radical, and in a group like this, probably there's a few of you that have struggled with tendencies with homosexuality. One quick story. When I was about 19 years old, I don't even know that I really knew what homosexuality was. I grew up in such a shelter environment. Late 70s, it just wasn't out. I didn't even realize men struggled with it. I used to work with antiques, and I worked with this guy who had top quality antiques. Well, in the antique world, there's lots of homosexuality. I had no clue about that. Every February, we'd go down to Florida and do this large antique show that ran for 16, 17 days at the Miami Beach Convention Center. The best antiques all around the country were there. Huge complex. And I would go down with this fellow. We'd take this big truckload of expensive antiques. And so I would help him set up and be there for a couple days, and then I'd have a couple weeks to do kind of what I wanted to. And at the end, I did that for 3 years with him. Well, the first year I was down there, we were at this hotel, and some of his friends were staying there at the hotel as well. I was this innocent little Amish boy that was helping him. We were sitting around the pool one of the first nights, and we all were drinking, had a beer, and we were drinking, and just social drinking. And the other guys were, I began to feel a little bit like there's something strange about them, the way that they were acting. Two guys were sitting beside each other. And then the guy went down with said to me, "Well, they're married." And I said, "They're what?" And I could not even comprehend that. I was so naive to me. I mean, I was so naive, and it was so foreign to me. Next day or two, he came to me and he said, in a joking way, he said, "Yeah, and the other fella that's there, he said he already has your number. He said he wants you." And when he told me that, I had again, to my shame, but I had again, we'd been sitting around the pool that evening and I had had a few beers. And I became extremely angry because something felt very violating to me to think that there's a man out there that wanted me. And I became sick, physically sick that night because it felt so, and it didn't have anything to do with the alcohol. I think probably my anger stirred out more from a little bit of alcohol. But I was so repulsed from the idea. I took the anger out in some ways that I won't go into. Then I started talking to this man that I had gone down with. And then he said, "You don't understand where this man comes out of. He was a barber in German Village in downtown Columbus, meddled also with antiques. He was on top of his world in the barber business." But my friend Bill said to me, what happened to this man when he was a little boy growing up is that his father left at a very early age, and he was raised by a domineering mother, and he didn't have a clue who he was. But one thing he did know, that he was trying to find connection, and he gravitated to homosexuality or to connection with a man to somehow find a facade back to that relationship of his father. And I could, over the years, I've been able to give him grace, even though I remember that scene very graphically. And I still feel this violation inside of me when I think about this man looking at me and wanting me. What can we give as fathers? What did you want as sons? Sons' wants and needs. Well, there is nothing that sons want more than time with their fathers. When my boys were little, Matthew and Ian, they're 14 and 16 today, many times when I would come home, my oldest son, he just loved when I play pitch and catch with him. There's many times that I didn't have time for that. There's times I did, and especially Sunday afternoons. They don't ask me anymore, very rarely. They'll ask me sometimes to go out and play basketball with them. But my youngest son, he asks me all the time. Almost every evening, he wants to do something. And I realize that my older sons don't ask me anymore, but my younger sons do. But I also realize that my older sons are nothing more than big babies, big little boys. They still have that same heart's desire for dad to spend time with them. But they don't have just that freedom just to come say, "Dad, can we go out and play pitch and catch?" And so the question is, will I move and enter into their hearts? Will I create that space and that time to meet with them? Will I go up and sit in their room? One of the things that I learned from Dan Beachy early on at Life Ministries, when he would talk about, I often ponder with Dan about fathering. And he said, well, he remembers when his oldest son, at times, when he began to drift at 15, 16, and Nate went through some things, right, Tim? But when Dan began to see that, he said, I began to spend lots of time up in his room. I said, what would you do? He said, I think they had bunk beds. He said, I just lay in the other bed. I said, what did you talk about? Anything that Nate wanted to talk about. Nate knew all about sports, so I talked about sports. And if you know Dan Beachy, for him to talk about sports, you know, that's a stretch. But he entered into. The question is, have you been entered into by your father in your world, spending time together? Life skills, teaching, training. being able to be there. Did you teach your sons about changing the oil in his car? Were you taught about keeping a checkbook? Who taught you how to speak to the opposite sex at 16 and 17? Who talked to you about being honorable young men to your authorities? Who teaches these kind of skills that matter when we become adults or become accountable? A father is the one, you know, if you read Psalm 78 and if you read Deuteronomy 6, it's very clear that God had designed us fathers, for fathers to be the front rows, to be the evangelists of our sons and daughters, to teach them, to train them in the way that they should go. And so often that stuff gets handed out to other people, to the Sunday school teachers, to the pastors. But God said, no, I want you men to be in the front line of teaching your sons the life skills about me. And the way when they walk, when they sit down, when they lie down, wherever they're at, teaching our sons the things that really matter. Train a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. That's a simple truth. Directions with a solid why questions. Right now, I have a son that he just needs to know why in so many different categories. Music, lots of dialogue about music. This is a category that I never had to ponder with my dad. This is a category that my father, it was hard for him to have the time, even the space, for me to ask the why question. When I was a little boy, I remember saying to my dad at times, "Favas," which is Dutch for why. And my father would say, "Fadas, Favas, Fadas." I still don't know what Fadas means, but something to do. Can somebody tell me what that means? Because, I guess, why? Because, yeah. That never satisfied me, you know? That's what he would give, Fadas, and that's it. Can we teach our children why we believe what we do? Why do we do things like this? Why do we make it, you know, why do we believe in separation? On and on and on. There's so many why questions that need to be answered for young sons. And if you don't tell them why, they don't really know what you stand for, what you believe in. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. They say there's more caught than taught. That boys tend to model after their fathers what their fathers really do and what they believe and what they say. Saturday, I'm trying to sell my old car. And so I just put it in the paper. And I had it advertised for $800, my 86 Camry. And I began getting calls, and this guy came out. And he was wearing a Harley Davidson leather hat, and he had all sorts of tattoos. And I knew I was going to be in for a challenge when he came looking at my car, took it for a spin. My sons were there, and he came back, and I put in the paper I won $800 for my car. He was telling me all sorts of things that were wrong with it. And then he said, "The very best I'll give you is $650, no more." I said, "I'd like at least $700. "Nope, $650. That's it." "Okay," I said, "you know what? I want to sell the car." "Fine, $650. So we're talking about where we were going to have to go get the title changed. And he said, "Oh, one more thing." He said, "I want you to know that when we get there, you're going to have to tell them that I only paid $200 for this car. I'm not paying the government any more money. They get more of my money than me." And here I had a choice. What am I going to stand for? I really wanted to sell my car. But to make a long story short, he left without my car. He left actually pretty angry, because he gave me round after round of why he isn't paying the government another cent. And as he would go through these rounds, I was thinking, you know what? I could just drop the price. It's $27. I can just drop the price another $25. Let him have it. And I'll pay for it. And something inside of me said, that's not the right thing. God must have a better plan. How do we model to our sons? What are we modeling? What my father modeled to me in categories about work ethic, about diligence, about being steady, about being gentle. My father was a gentle giant, big man. My father was much bigger than I am. He's a very strong man. When I was 12 years old, I remember my father, when all the uncles were together and they got out of scales. And they had, you know, and you press the scales and you see how far you can push him in. And different men were pushing him in 180, 220, 240. And my father was the only one that pushed it all the way back to the back end, 260. He was a strong man. I was proud of my dad in so many ways. But my father was also, I think, a man that taught lots about convictions, about truth. You will leave with your son what you've modeled in your home. And finally, the last one, real quick, is dad's heart. What a son needs more than anything is your heart and your passion and your love. It was important to Jesus. Two times we have in the story of Jesus, when he began his ministry in Mark 1:11, and again at the Mount of Transfiguration in Luke 17. Two times we have the story of the Father speaking to his son and saying, this is my son. How many of you have ever heard your father say, this is my son, to somebody else? This is my son. How many of you heard your dad say that? How many have heard you heard your dad say, this is my son, I love him, in whom I am well pleased? Have you ever heard your father say that? After I became a Christian and I went to Fresh Start, I was working there. I always, you know, my dad, because work was so important to him, being in ministry work, it didn't quite match up. He wanted a son to be able to provide for his family. That was really important to my dad. And so I didn't know how, but my dad would always call me once a week. On Sundays, he would call me. But he would never say, Sam, you know, I like what you're doing. I think you're making a difference. I think God called you there. Although we had asked for his blessing to go. But I would hear from other men that they would say, yeah, I was talking to your dad the other day and he told me, yeah, you're, you know. And so I think that my father was saying in a roundabout way that I would never have heard, that he was proud of, that I was making a difference, that I had changed my life at 27 and that I was trying to make a difference. And that would be the way that I would have gotten my father's heart, by hearing stories. I asked you the question a little bit ago, how many of you heard your father say to someone else, or even looking you in the eyes and say, this is my son, or you are my son, and would have heard him say, I'm well pleased in you. I love who you are. You make my heart happy. I didn't see many hands. Now, when we began this morning, I also asked you the question, how many of you are dads this morning? And so I ask you the question now, how many of you have spoken those words to your sons? Either directly to them, in their eyes, or where they've heard somebody else say them. When I would be working with my father on the job site, I always liked when my dad, if the homeowner would come out, or I would take my father to a place of business because he was Amish, he couldn't drive, and I'd take him to the electrical contractor or the plumbing store or wherever. I would like when my dad would say, I would hear him say, that's my son Samuel over there. It didn't happen often, but a few times. And I felt connected to my father's heart. Every son wants to be connected to a dad's heart. One quick story. I think this is actually normal. This is healthy. This is a story of a boy who became a man whose father died when he was little. My father was killed in World War II when I was 3 years old. I knew in my heart that he loved me. My mother told me that he loved me, but I always longed to hear it for myself from him. When my mother and stepfather retired and left Alaska, I came over one day to help them pack. Mom took an old army photograph of my father in his army uniform off of her dresser and gave it to me, and she said, "Here, this is for you. I know your father would have wanted you to have it. It was the same photograph I had seen for many years. As I took the picture from her, I accidentally dropped it, and the cheap metal frame hit the floor and broke, shattering the glass. Sick at heart, I reached down to salvage what was left of this family treasure. But behind the photograph, I found a letter placed there 37 years before and long forgotten. It was a letter from my father to me, his 3-year-old son, the last letter he had written before he died. And in it, he said that he loved me and that he longed to come home and be with me. Unbelievably, I finally heard the words that I had longed to hear from a dad who was long since dead. 40-year-old man, hearing the words from his dad that he had never heard before. Let's pray. Father, this morning I thank you that you have given us fathers. Lord, most of us are fathers today, and you are calling us out. But Lord, this morning we remember our dad. We're grateful for what you've given us, Lord. Lord, also I'm aware that there's men this morning that we all have been wounded. And I pray that as they begin to ponder and to think about their father wound inside, that you would enable them to process in deep ways, in meaningful ways. Thank you, Lord, that you are the true Father and that you love us purely and completely and perfectly. In Jesus' name, amen.